Hello, hi everybody, and welcome to the War Room Show from the War HQ. This show is entitled Pavlov's House. And so in this podcast, we're going to be looking at one of the most iconic actions in the Battle of Stalingrad. First, we're going to look at what we think we know about the action. Then we will look at the run-up to the action and give you an idea of the geography of the battle area around Pavlov's House, which leads on to what happened during the actual battle. We're going to meet some of the Soviet participants during that, and a brief study of the aftermath follows. Then a roll call of some of the people who were actually there, their units, the rank, weaponry, etc. We're going to start finishing up by looking at the building of a bolt action list to theme the defenders of Pavlov's House. And to finish off, we are going to have a wee quiz to see what you all know now. Or, if you like, did you listen to the podcast the whole way through? So at this stage, I would just like to let you know that this podcast is brought to you with the support of my supporters on Patreon at patreon.com/warhq. And at the moment, the roll call stands at Randy Wapperom, Graham Hart, Rob Beckman, Lauren McLaren, Graham Thompson, and Phil Masson. War HQ Warriors, I salute you. So, let's get on to it. So what do we think we know before we start finding out a little bit more about this? Well, most of what we know at the moment commonly comes mostly from Soviet propaganda of the time and has come down through the ages. So most of the things that some of us or could say about the whole action was the action took place at Pavlov's house on the 27th of September 1942, Sergeant Jacob Pavlov led six soldiers into an apartment block on the 9th of January Square in Stalingrad and took the house on their own. On the 29th, 2 days after, reinforcements were sent and Pavlov's garrison swelled to 20 men. And then a few days later, another four men made it to the house, and this became the 24 men who held off the German army for 58 days. Then we know that by chance they were from every region of the Soviet Union. And we know that they had one record player with one record that they played constantly for the 58 days. We might also know that the Germans would never take the house back. And we also possibly have heard that Major General Vasily Chukov of the 62nd Army, he was the commander of the army, boasted that Pavlov's men killed more Germans than the Germans lost in the capture of Paris. So moving on to the events as they actually happened, it's quite a challenge to sort out the fact from fiction over this particular action, mainly because the most accounts contradict each other, certainly in some regards, and the Soviets sealed official documents regarding this particular action very quickly, and they may have provided some evidence to support the official accounts of the time. So we're looking at first-hand accounts and interviews and some common sense and some of the recent books that have come out covered by authors who have researched the subject. So here we're looking mainly at Stalingrad by Anthony Beaver, Stalingrad, How the Red Army Triumphed by Michael E. Jones, probably the best account for my money, Enemy at the Gates by William Craig, and Armageddon in Stalingrad by David Glantz. Hopefully we will come to an agreement on the most likely scenario, and I'm sure you'll find the actual story is just as amazing as the myth behind the whole thing. What we do know is that Major General Vasily Chukov led the 62nd Army, and the 13th Guards Rifle Division was part of that army, and they were led by General Alexander Rodometsev, and these are the main protagonists in this particular action from the Soviet side. Now, the 13th Guards crossed the Volga on the 15th of September and lost more than 3,000 troops in the first 24 hours, reportedly. However, they did capture many of the key strong points at that time. However, by the 25th of September, the 13th Guards were pushed back and were only holding a thin strip of land along the west bank of the Volga. A strip of land about 1,500 metres in length down the side of the river and only about 100 to 300 metres wide. Major General Chukov now realised that the tactics they were using would need to change if they were going to successfully defend the city, and he issued Order 166 and instructed commanders not to use entire units to carry out operations. He wanted them to use small groups armed with hand grenades, submachine guns, anti-tank rifles, and they called these groups storm groups. Using these storm groups meant only a portion of a company were committed to an attack at a time, while the rest of the troops remained on the defensive. Sergeant Pavlov led a group of about five others in a storm group on the evening of 27th of September 42. To go and take the building known as the lighthouse. Using grenades, they neutralised the German defenders, and with artillery support from the relatively safe east bank of the Volga, they were successful in taking the building. The Germans, 71st Infantry Division, 194th Infantry Regiment, were positioned only about 7 to 100 metres away from the building, and they did not counterattack immediately, somewhat surprisingly. Perhaps they were thinking a much larger force had taken the lighthouse. Contrary to the propaganda, the taking of the lighthouse was not a major area of the battle, as the Germans had concentrated their efforts to the north of the 9th of January Square, where the main battle in fact raged. At dawn, Pavlov and his men defended the building against at least two relatively small-scale attacks, and probably more over the next couple of days. 2 days after Pavlov's storm group had assaulted the building and taken it, Lieutenant Ivan Afanasyev, forgive my pronunciation of the Russian, led his platoon, 30 or so troops, to reinforce the building, and additional reinforcements arrived over the next few months, at least another 50 or more. The legend says 24 men held the building, but survivors say after the reinforcement, there was never less than 70 at any one time. And they didn't come from every area of the Soviet Union. We can say with some certainty that they had at least two heavy machine guns, two light machine guns, four anti-tank rifles, and two 51mm mortars, and multiple rifles and submachine guns. This suggests that more than 24 men were in the garrison. A trench was dug from Pavlov's house to the mill behind it, which still stands there as a memorial to this day. And this supplied them with troops and supplies. On October the 1st, Major General Chukov made an order 179. It said, "Every trench and every dugout should be reinforced and each building shall become a towering fortress. To fulfil this task, new engineering works and obstacles must be built. Buildings and houses turned into firing points for heavy machine guns. Communications trenches dug and minefields and barbed wire emplacements set out. Our strong points must also be equipped with anti-tank guns and mortars." He went on to say, "All these measures are aimed at making our defence unbreakable, for all the furious attacks of the fascist troops will shatter upon these obstacles as sea waves are broken by granite rock." Makes the nickname of the lighthouse even more probable after that little speech. Sappers, most probably from the 13th Guards of the 18th Sapper Battalion, in fact went out and mined the surrounding area and the approaches. They laid barbed wire and dug trenches for gun positions and telephone wires. Incidentally, the neighbouring identical building was taken by the 42nd Guards, but it was destroyed in late September by German artillery strikes. Pavlov's house was also frequently visited by snipers from the 62nd Army. The most famous of the visitors was Anatoly Chekhov, who was 19 years old during the Battle of Stalingrad. Chekhov was credited with 256 kills, many of them likely came from Pavlov's house. In addition to defending Pavlov's house, the building's defenders were often called on to participate in storm group assaults against German positions in nearby buildings. From late September until late November, elements of the 13th Guards tried multiple times to clear surrounding buildings. However, it was not until the 19th of November that the 13th Guards began to achieve some success in their storm groups. Meanwhile, the defenders in Pavlov's house were tasked with clearing the milk house, which was across the 9th of January Square. For 2 months, the defenders of the two strongholds, Pavlov's house and the milk house, had skirmished, and this was the first major effort to clear the milk house since mid-September. The order to clear the milk house came on the 24th of November, and the assault was carried over onto the 25th of November. The attack was led by the commander of the 7th Company, Senior Lieutenant Ivan Naumov, and included Lieutenant Afanasyev, Pavlov, and most of the other defenders. The storm group met with initial success, but the Germans counterattacked in force, and most of the defenders from Pavlov's house were killed or seriously injured. Pavlov was one of those injured and had to be evacuated. This failed storm group assault marked the propagandic end of the defence of Pavlov's house due to the combination of Pavlov's departure from the building and the near concurrent beginning of Operation Uranus, which was the encirclement by the Soviets of the German forces in Stalingrad. By the end of the Battle of Stalingrad, Pavlov's house had taken on mythological propaganda significance by the Soviets. Exaggerations surrounding the strong point story made it difficult to separate fact from fiction, and a problem that has been made worse by the reporting, especially in Western sources. It seems confident to say that there was initially 4 or 6 involved in the initial storming of what became known latterly as Pavlov's house, and that they did hold on to it with only those sort of 6 men for a couple of days before reinforcements came. So how long did the defenders hold the house for? 58 days as what the legend says, but in truth, ironically, if you like, it was actually held much longer than that. The 58 days corresponds really to the time Pavlov and his 4 or 6 man assault group initially took the Pavlov's house, to the time where Pavlov was taken from the battlefield injured after the failed storm group raid on the milk house. Lieutenant Anton Dragon took charge of the building after that time until they were moved up to go to the Red October factory, and the Wehrmacht took over Pavlov's house. He then came back on the 30th of January and had to boot the German defenders back out again. Only 24 defenders? This was an attempt really to paint a picture of a small group of defenders holding out against a numerically superior enemy. And this played exactly into the propaganda writer's hands and was the correct image for the time that the Soviets wanted to portray as the small man holding on against impossible odds. However, as we've heard, there was never really less than about 70 men there, if we are to believe the first-hand accounts, and in fact the true number of defenders could be as up to as many as 100 defenders at certain points, including machine gunners, anti-tank rifle gunners, sappers, forward observers, etc. So probably more men than was reported in the Soviet press. Yes, the defenders were totally heroic and stood their ground. And it was a fantastic action in spite of the tall stories and embellishments afterwards. It was a it's a fantastic story, and nobody really mentions the part that the forward observers and the artillery played. They made it much more possible for that house to be defended for as long as it was, and they played a vital part in the defending of Pavlov's house, or the lighthouse, depending on which period of history we are reading this from. That artillery barrages that were brought in from the east bank of the Volga, because Pavlov's house was fairly close to the river, it meant that they could be fairly accurate with their bombardments when the Germans did attack the building. So you really need to look at the whole thing, an overall picture of the whole thing. Everybody played the part, but yes, the defenders were heroic and were absolutely fantastic, but they had helps of a lot of people. They had the help of the sappers, the help of the artillery, the help of the communications. It was a whole team effort, and it worked out very well, and it gave us a brilliant story. Who was actually in charge? It's become known as Pavlov's house, Sergeant Pavlov, obviously. However, a couple of days afterwards, it was Lieutenant Afanasyev who came and reinforced, and you would presume would actually take charge. I'm sure Pavlov played a huge part in it, but it seems unlikely that the lieutenant would not take charge. And in fact, in his own book, he does say that he was in charge of defending the Pavlov's house until the failed lighthouse attack. But regardless, the legend was built around Sergeant Pavlov. He was awarded Russia's highest award for bravery at the time, along with one or two others who took part in the defense. And he in fact lived out the war and survived. So the defense of Pavlov's house became a mustering point, if you like, for propaganda and the stories. And it was just one of several other places in Stalingrad which they turned into small fortresses to keep the Germans at bay and from crossing the Volga, which they managed to do by the skin of the teeth. This hold up to the Germans, stopping them in their tracks with the intensive hand-to-hand and building-to-building fighting, allowed the Russian Operation Uranus to encircle the German army, I think it was the 6th Army in Stalingrad, and basically they destroyed them. The Germans tried to airlift them out, and then the Russians counterattacked and chased the Germans most of the way back to Germany. So a turning point of the war for the Russians and the Germans. So bolt action and building an army. Well, I've managed to find online a listing of some, at least, of the defenders, what their ranks were, what unit they were, and weaponry, etc. And I'm going to put those up as a PDF, which you can get at my Patreon page for free at patreon.com/warhq. We're going to put that up there so you can see individual soldiers, and that will help you to build bolt action themed armies for this. So, looking to the campaign Stalingrad book, I think is where I would go, and I would look at the No Land Beyond the Volga Reinforced Platoon. Now, that would be on page 138. Now, the reason I would go for this one is because it allows you to use storm group squads. And of course, Pavlov was in a storm group, and from the house they use storm groups. So this is why I go for this one. Let's have a look at the special rules for this reinforced platoon before I go over it in detail. No transports. The Soviet forces within the city almost completely without motorized transport or horses. Heavy weapons had to be manhandled into place from one part of the city to the other and made the harrowing journey on foot. No transport or tow options are available for this force. Off-map battery, which is really good for this particular force because we know there was good and fairly comprehensive artillery support. Because let's read it through properly. So Chukov wisely ordered that all divisional artillery stay on the eastern bank of the Volga. There were no safe locations to position artillery within Stalingrad, and in any case moving heavy guns through the ruined streets was nearly impossible. As such, Soviet players are not allowed to take artillery units. Instead, to represent the considerable firepower amassed on the eastern bank of the Volga, forward observers taken in this list may order a second artillery strike after the first strike has been resolved. I like that a lot. It's very thematic. It keeps artillery off. I know some people prefer that. They think that artillery on the bolt action table is a little out of keeping with the ranges and things. Whatever, but I particularly like that nuance. And they can have fanatical defense. So any Soviet unit can be fanatics for just plus 3 points per model. I like that a lot. It themes into the whole Pavlov's house thing quite nicely. So let's go through what you can take. You can take a lieutenant, junior or second. You can have infantry squads from Siberian Rifle, LMG squads, SMG squads, guard squads, veteran squads, Strafbat squads, airborne squads, or naval brigade squads. You can have headquarter choices, a captor or major, a politruck, a medical team, a forward artillery observer. So let's have a look at those first. So we would probably have a junior lieutenant to theme with the Pavlov's house. And I would probably, from the choice I've got there, I would probably take two guard squads, I think, or possibly two veteran squads, and that would make up my my core choices that I have to take. As regards headquarters, I wouldn't take a captain or a major. I wouldn't take a politruck. I probably wouldn't take a medical team, but I'd definitely take a forward artillery observer, making use of that off-map battery special rule for this list. In the infantry choices, what we can take as the same as we've just said before, although the LMG squad can only take one LMG per squad. In fact, all the squads can only take one LMG per squad. You can also add to the choice scout squads. Scout squads I like quite a lot. And up to three storm squads and up to one assault engineer squad. So we've not got down to the actual listing bit there. But for the rest of the troop choices there, I'm looking at scout squads, storm squads, and an assault engineers squad. You can take one MMG, one HMG. I'm not sure there, but you can take two sniper teams, or two Zaychacha teams, or two sniper detachments. We'll come back and talk about that later. We'll go and have a look at what they give us. You can take a flamethrower team. You can take two anti-tank rifle teams or two anti-tank hunter teams. You can take a mortar and a light mortar. Out of that, I would be inclined to look at two sniper teams, a flamethrower team. I am inclined to take two anti-tank teams. It's very thematic, and I think there's something to be gained by that. I would take a heavy mortar to theme it, and that's what I would take from there. You can take artillery in this list, but if I'm theming it to Pavlov's house, I really wouldn't take it. The only choices you have with guns are an anti-tank. I'm assuming it's a light anti-tank gun, a medium anti-tank gun, and a ZIS-2 anti-tank gun. You can take a ZIS-3 divisional gun, and you can also take an 85mm or an A19 field gun. Not sure. I'm assuming that's light, heavy, and medium. Light, medium, and heavy. The ZIS-3 is a great choice, but for this particular list, I'm probably not going to take artillery, as I mentioned before. Armored cars, you can take a recce car from a BA-10, 20, or 64. If I was being competitive, I would probably take one of those, but I probably won't for this. And you can take tank destroyers, self-propelled artillery and anti-aircraft vehicles from T-60, T-70, T-34, OT-34, KV-1, KV-1S, KV-8, KV-8S, a Tokarov Quad Maxim, or an SU-76I. I think for this themed list, I am going to stay away from tanks, although it might be an interesting take on it. So for this army, it looks as though it's going to be an infantry army because we're theming it on Pavlov's house. So let's go on and see what list I actually come up with. But before that, I nearly forgot, let's go and have a look at the actual units. So let me see if I can come back here. So the new units that we haven't come across are the sniper detachment, which is veteran only, 65 points, one NCO and four men. They come armed with rifles, but up to two men can have sniper rifles for 30 points each. And the NCO can have a submachine gun for 3 points. So it gives us a five-man squad, sniper detachment special rule, on a fire order, decide whether all models in the unit will fire their weapons normally, or the unit will use its sniper rifles. If you decide on the latter course, only the sniper rifle armed models can fire. They must target the same enemy unit and declare the models they are targeting before firing is resolved. This can be the same model or two separate models in the target unit. So that would be, we could have two of those squads. And in the Zaichata squad, regular infantry this time for 120 points, one NCO and two men. But they come armed with sniper rifles already. Master and Zichata. One sniper is the master sniper, the other two are the Zichata in training. The master sniper should be differentiated in some way and acts as an NCO. If the master sniper is killed, the quality of the squad drops to inexperienced, as the two Zichata no longer have a veteran guidance to rely upon, in addition to the normal morale penalty for losing the NCO. However, should both Zichata be removed from play and only the master sniper remains, his quality will upgrade to veteran. They have the team spotting rule. On a fire order, you decide who will fire, the master sniper or the Zichata. The other acts as a spotter and may not fire. If the Zichata fire, they must target the same enemy unit and declare the models they are targeting before firing is resolved. This can be the same model or two separate models in the target. So, two very similar units allows you to have up to four snipers in a squad if you take two of these units, which is very handy. I can see they're fairly expensive. I think possibly the veteran infantry choice at the base of 65 points for five men plus your 60 points for sniper rifles is 125. is probably much better value, although expensive. Now, the other unit that we were talking about, the Storm Group. The Storm Group is a four-man unit, one NCO and three men. You can take it regular for 56 points or veteran for 68. You can have four additional men with SMGs up to 14 points. Sorry, the original four come with SMGs. Or 14 points regular or 17 points veteran. And you can equip them with anti-tank grenades. So, special rules, armed to the teeth. Storm groups are especially equipped for close quarters combat. Aside from submachine guns, they carry extra grenades, knives and sharpened spades. Storm groups always precede their attack with a hail of grenades. Whenever this unit initiates close quarters combat with an enemy unit, the enemy cannot take advantage of the defensive position rules. Storm groups always attack first in any close quarter fight that they initiate. Interesting. So, let's go off and build a list. So, I have now come up with a list, not a super competitive list, it should still be quite fun, using the No Land Beyond the Volga reinforced platoon from page 138 of the new Campaign Stalingrad book, as I've said. So let's go through it. You can point out all my glaring mistakes, I'm sure, as we go through. So we've gone for a veteran junior lieutenant, 65 points on his own. I like small teams to be veteran. Makes them harder to take out with snipers. I've got two 10-man guard squads. They're regular with an LMG in each. They will come in at 120 points. I've got the 12 free inexperienced squad that we get as part of the Soviet National Rules. They come armed with grenades and rifles. I've got one forward artillery observer on his own, again veteran, trying to keep him survivable to get those two artillery strikes in using the off-map battery special rule for this list. He's 90 points. I've got a commissar, inexperienced, at 15 points. I've got a six-man storm group veteran squad with grenades for 114 points. This is going to be one that my Sergeant Pavlov will be in. And I have another eight-man storm group with grenades at 152 points. I have two anti-tank rifle teams, veteran at 39 points, a flamethrower team, veteran at 65 points, a light mortar, that's a 50mm mortar, to keep with the theming of the army, for 46 points. And I've taken one sniper detachment with sniper rifles, their veteran, 135 points. And that will come to on or about 1,000 points exactly, I believe. Now, not the most competitive list. Big drawback is very little anti-tank and no transport whatsoever. But it could be a fun army to play with. And whilst won't win every game, it would certainly put up a good showing against some armies. If I was changing it around to get more competitive, I would possibly... We need to get some anti-tank in there. So I'd possibly change out the guard squads for veteran squads and put two Panzerfaust in each of those squads. Theming it, we don't really have much more anti-tank. I would possibly take out one of the storm groups and put in assault engineers to give me two flamethrowers. Even though they don't have transport, they could still take out those vehicles you're going to come across enemy armies with. I've got the AT rifles in there. Thematic, use them as a poor man sniper. You've kind of got, with the sniper detachment and the two anti-tank rifles, even on a veteran squad, you can make them wince a little bit with that. So I like that. Light mortar team, difficult squad to kill, put down, could use it for trying to take out smaller teams on the enemy, like snipers, etc., if you can get close enough and survive, I guess. So that's my list for 1,000 points, theming it on the Pavlov's house story. What would your list be like? Let me know. So you can get the answers by listening back through the podcast, or you can contact me. The contact details will follow, and I will send you the answers and see how you did. Why not go to our Facebook and let me know how you did in our little quiz, and we'll see you again on the next podcast of The War Room from The War HQ. Mahalo for now. Got to the end of that. Well done. So now we're going to ask you one or two wee questions. First of all, what was the name that the troops gave to Pavlov's house at the actual time? We know Pavlov's house became known as that after the engagement. What was it known at the time as? Next question. There were many people at Pavlov's house, anywhere between 24 and 100 or so, depending on the account you listen to. But we do know there were some snipers at Pavlov's house. Name the famous sniper that was at Pavlov's house. Name the famous sniper at Pavlov's house. Pavlov eventually left the battlefield. On what building was the attack where Pavlov was injured? What rank was Yakov Pavlov? What rank did Yakov Pavlov hold? What is the significance of 9th of January to Pavlov's house? What is the significance of the 9th of January to Pavlov's house? In what campaign selector in the campaign Stalingrad book can you take storm groups? In what campaign selector in the campaign Stalingrad book can you take storm squads? How many points does it cost for an inexperienced commissar? How many points does an inexperienced commissar cost? What bank of the Volga River was Pavlov's house? Was it on the east bank or was it on the west bank? What side of the Volga River was Pavlov's house? Was it on the east or the west of the Volga River? And lastly, Stalingrad is between which two seas? Stalingrad is between which two seas? So, how do you think you got on with that? Did you get all 9 questions correct? Shall we go on and see? So, the first question we asked was, what was the name of Pavlov's house before it was called Pavlov's house? So the name that the soldiers referred to it during the Battle of Leningrad. And the name that was used was the Lighthouse. The Lighthouse. The second question we asked was, there was a famous sniper who served at Pavlov's house. Can you name him? And his name was Anatoly Chekhov. Anatoly Chekhov. The third question was, what building was the attack upon when Pavlov was injured? What building was Pavlov attacking when he got injured and was removed from the Battle of Stalingrad? The name of the building was the Milk House. The Milk House. In the fourth question, we asked you, what was Pavlov's rank? A nice easy one. Pavlov was a sergeant. A sergeant. Now, the fifth question we asked was, what was the significance of the 9th of January when we're referring to Pavlov's house? Well, 9th of January Square was the square upon which Pavlov's house was situated. So the 9th of January refers to the square upon which Pavlov's house was situated. Number 6, we took a wee stroll into the campaign Stalingrad book, and we asked you which selector could you take storm groups in? And that selector was the No Land Beyond the Volga reinforced platoon selector. So that was the No Land Beyond the Volga reinforced platoon selector from the campaign Stalingrad book. Then we asked you how many points was an inexperienced commissar from the Soviet army book, and it was 15 points. An inexperienced commissar is 15 points. Question 8 was, which bank of the Volga River was Pavlov's house on? There was only two choices for this, so 50-50 chance of getting this right at least. It was either the west or the east bank, and Pavlov's house is on the west bank. Pavlov's house is on the west bank. And finally, we asked you, between which two seas does Stalingrad stand? And the answers were between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. That's the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. So how did you do, guys? Why not message me? Let me know how you did. No cheating, mind. No cheating. And that really brings us to the end of this Pavlov's House podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Please contact me with comments. Anything like that, more than happy to hear your feedback, and let me know if you want to hear another one of these historical War Room podcasts. So take care, guys. Hope you're all doing well, and hopefully I'll see you all soon. Mahalo for now. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, a bit of a favour to ask. Totally understand if you don't want to become a patron, but if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get the podcast, and if you could give me a 5-star rating and a glowing review, I'd really appreciate that. It would boost us right up the charts. I know it's really tiresome, but I'd be ever so grateful if you could do that for me. Thank you, and mahalo. You can get in touch with us on patreon.com/warhq or at warhq.co.uk@gmail.com or on Facebook at warhq.co.uk.